If you are here for the first time, my name's Michael. I'm one of the pastors here at the church, and I'm excited to be here with you today. We are starting a brand new series in the book of James. So if you have a Bible, go ahead and open up to the book of James, if you would. The series I'm entitling is called A Life Well Lived, and I want to ask you that question as we get started. What does that mean? What does it look like to have a life that is well lived? What is that, practically speaking, what does that look like for you? You get to the end of your life, and you're looking back over your life. What would it take, what would it look like for you to say, that was a life that was well lived? Two weekends ago, I think it was, I took some friends and a camera crew down to the Boston Commons, and we interviewed as many people that would talk to us, and we got probably about 65 people to talk to us, and we asked them that question. What does it mean? A life well lived. What does that look like for you? And it was amazing how many people quoted the pursuit of life, liberty, and happiness, and that kind of thing. A lot of people talked about family. A lot of people talked about just love and relationships and finances and making money and having security and all that kind of stuff, all of which are fine answers. But it was amazing how many people got stopped in their tracks, as it were. Most people said, I'm sorry, can you repeat the question? And I said, yeah, what does it look like, a life well lived? What does that mean? And so many people had a common response of, I have no idea. I've never thought of that before. And I said, well, let's think about it. What do you think it would look like? And after sometimes literally just a few minutes of just some silence and the film rolling, they would say, you know what, I don't even know, but I'll think about it. I'm guessing here, but there was roughly about 65 people. We actually engaged probably about 68, 69 people, and almost everyone was willing to sit and talk with me for a little bit and even get on camera, which was very interesting. So those who think Boston is not a friendly place, you're wrong. They love it. Only one person said God. I don't know. I wasn't actually shocked or surprised by that. But it was some lady who was probably about 60, 65 years old mentioned, well, it has something to do with God. And that was the extent of her comment. But so many people, it was just, they were stuck. They couldn't figure out what a life well-lived looks like. So how about you? What does it look like, a life well-lived? It's a pretty important question because it would be a shame to get to the end of your life only to realize you missed it. I mean, that to me would be tragic, to get to the end of your life and say, you know what? Why didn't I do this? Why didn't I work through that? Why didn't I think about that? And get to the life and actually, end of your life, and actually just miss it. So it's certainly not an easy question, but I think it's a question we should wrestle with because it's pretty important. And that's why I'm entitling this series A Life Well Lived, because James paints a picture for us of what a life well-lived looks like. James, it's a letter that is very practical in nature of what it actually looks like to be a person who is in relationship with God, a person who is following Christ. So the concern is not as much about doctrine or just theoretical knowledge. His concern throughout the entire five chapters of this letter is, what does it actually mean? What does it actually look like to be a person who calls themselves a Christian or a Christ follower? I wanted to offer a challenge, if you would. Be okay over these next few weeks just to get real uncomfortable. Be okay to get real uncomfortable, because James, he just doesn't hold back. He asks tough questions. He just doesn't hold back any punches. He asks tough questions about life and what life in God looks like and how it should look like and what it's supposed to look like. So please, over these next few weeks, be okay to be uncomfortable, as it were. I mean, the basic message of the whole book is, if you claim to have a relationship with God through Jesus Christ, your life will look different. Not could look different, not should look different, but if you claim to be a person who has faith, faith specifically in God through Jesus Christ, your life will look different. It's not an option. It's not an invitation even. It's the truth. It's a reality that if you're a person who claims faith, your life will be different. One of the things that's exciting to me about this book is it speaks to so many different levels of just heart and soul. You might be here today and you have not made a decision to be in relationship with God through Christ. This is going to be a great journey, as it were, for you, because this is going to paint a picture of what it looks like to be a person who follows Jesus Christ. If you recently made a decision for Jesus, maybe even this past Easter, made the decision, I want to get right with God, I want to begin that relationship with Him, then this is painting a picture of what your new life in Christ will look like. And if you're a person who's been walking with God for some time now, how many ever months or years that has been, let me just remind you, you haven't arrived yet. None of us have arrived yet. So let this book be okay to force you to examine, how am I really doing as a Christ follower? Be okay to be examined and have the tough questions, to wrestle with those tough questions. Father, I just pray as we start and begin this journey through really just a great letter, the letter of James. Father, I pray that we would be okay to get uncomfortable, as it were, and wrestle with some of the tough questions that this letter is going to pose to us. Father, I pray that this very specifically, as we have gathered here this morning, God, I believe and trust that your word, scriptures, the Bible, is living, it is active, and can speak to the heart and soul of every man and every woman in this place. And so, Father, I pray that your voice would be the loudest voice that we hear this morning, and God, that we would respond to what your word, to what your voice would speak to us in this place this morning. So God, as we get going, would you please guide us through our travels through James? Would you bless us through our travels through James? And God, ultimately, help us to get to know you, and consequently, God, that we would be different because of that, of a relationship with you. I pray that in Jesus' name. Amen. All right, some context for you. This is a book that was roughly written about 15 years after Jesus was resurrected. So roughly about 15 years or so after the church initially got going. And the first 15 years weren't, they weren't that smooth. It was a very rough transition because being a Christian, a Christ follower in first century was not the most popular thing to do. And so early Christians were, like many Christians actually today in this world, are facing a tremendous or a great deal amount of persecution. And so this is a letter that James wrote. Some people say it's actually the first letter that is written in the New Testament. And it's largely written certainly to encourage those who have made decisions to follow Jesus Christ, but it's also to not just encourage, but to exhort people to, if you're going to be a Christian, if you're going to be in relationship with Jesus, this is what that life looks like. This is what that life entails. I know it's a crazy concept, but if you're going to be a Christian, your life should look a little different. I know that's hard sometimes for us to grasp, but if we claim to have faith, that faith in us, working in us and through us, should have an impact on who we are. James chapter 1, if you're there, we're going to work through hopefully about 12 verses today. James chapter 1 says this: James, a servant of God and of the Lord Jesus Christ, to the 12 tribes scattered among the nations, greetings. Two questions. Who's James? A lot of speculation on James in terms of who he is. Most people have arrived at the conclusion, as well as I have, that James is the half-brother of Jesus. There was a disciple named James. He was the brother of John, followed Jesus for three some odd years. But he was, in Acts 12 records, he was actually martyred well before this book here could have been written. So most people say that James, nickname James the Just, was the author of this letter. He was known in Galatians chapter 2. Paul says James, the half-brother of Jesus, is a pillar of the church, along with Peter and along with John. So a lot of speculation, but at least I've arrived at the conclusion that James, who is recognized as a leader of the church, is the author of this book. And I love how he identifies himself. Of all of the things that he could have said, James, a pillar of the church, James, the half-brother of Jesus, James, the phenomenal leader that he certainly was. He says, James, I'm a servant. Doulos is the actual phrase there, which means a slave. I'm a slave. I am totally committed, as it were, to God and to Jesus Christ. I wonder where James got this concept of being a servant. I don't know. It might have come from Jesus saying something along the lines of, I came to serve, not to be served. He could have said so many things about himself, but he identifies himself first and foremost as a servant. And I don't know if you know this about James, but talk about a guy who had a faith journey. If you were to look at Mark chapter 3, verse 21, it says, when his family heard about this, they went to take charge of him, for they said, he is out of his mind. Okay, the family of Jesus was very concerned about what Jesus was doing in his early ministry years. And they basically had looked at Jesus and say, he's crazy. I mean, every family has one, right? Every family has that person where, like, everyone in the family's like, well, he's the crazy one in our family. We just got to put up with him. We're going to do the best we can to try and rope him back in. That was Jesus, apparently, in his family. Family, his brothers thought he was out of his mind. In John chapter 7, it even says, for even his own brothers did not believe him. Even his own brothers did not believe him. So something happened to James along his relationship with his half-brother Jesus. But in 1 Corinthians 15, Paul notes that he was amongst one of the believers who Jesus appeared to. I mean, I can't imagine what his journey to faith must have looked like. From saying that Jesus was just a crazy fool to someone that he could not believe in to someone he said, I'm serving. I'm totally committed to this person, Jesus. What amazing faith journey. He mentions that he's writing this letter to the 12 tribes that have been scattered. Most likely his audience that he has in mind is largely Jewish people who have recently converted to Christianity. Greetings. This is about as friendly as James is going to get. It's not like, hey, how are you guys doing? I hope all is well. I love you. I just, you know, I care so deeply for you. You have my heart. You know, my heart goes out to you. He just greetings. That's it. It's about as friendly as James is going to get, because real quickly he jumps now into the message that he has to communicate to people. I probably don't have to work too hard to convince you this morning that trials are a reality of life. I mean, if I asked you to actually raise your hand and say, is there anyone in here who has experienced a trial at some point in your life? I would imagine every single person in this room has experienced some sort of trial. I don't have to convince you that they're just part of life. They happen. But the question I'd like to ask you is, I want you to think for a minute to the last trial that you went through. It could have been just this morning and actually just getting here. It could have been over the weekend. It could be some relational conflict that you went through or still going through. But think for a minute, what's the last trial that you experienced or went through? Do you have that in mind? Okay, now I want you to answer the question, what did you look like at the end? When you hopefully came through that, and you literally might be in it right now, so hopefully today will be an encouragement, but also a challenge for you. But what did you look like at the end of the last trial that you went through? Were you bitter, or were you actually better off for having gone through that that trial? Did you have an attitude of just indifference, of I just don't care, and so you ignored it, sidestepped it, something along those lines? Or did something actually get created within you that led to growth or transformation? And just the title of the message this morning is, did you become jaded, or was there actually joy? So the result of your last trial you went through, what did you look like? because this is what James is going to speak to. A life well lived will be a life that when trials come up, and they will come up often, you will be a person who experiences joy, has an attitude, not an emotion, but an attitude of joy, not one where you become jaded towards life, towards God, towards people. So a life well lived is a life that has an attitude of joy, not one that is jaded. Chapter 1, verse 2 says this: "Consider it pure joy, my brothers, whenever you face trials of many kinds, because you know that the testing of your faith develops perseverance. Perseverance must finish its work so that you may be mature and complete, not lacking anything." We're pretty reactive people, right? So when something comes up, we react. And there's often consequences for our initial reaction. So if you find yourself in the midst of the trial, because we are so reactive, we don't take time just to do what James says first. Just stop. Just consider. Be slow. Be still. This word consider actually is evaluate. So rather than reacting and responding so quickly to the trial when it comes up, and it will, just stop. Just be slow. And consider the trial, consider the circumstance, the situation, evaluate what is happening, what's not happening, so that after careful consideration, careful evaluation, you might actually have the right response, not the wrong response. I love how it says when trials come up, it doesn't say get frustrated, get worried, be anxious, start freaking out, start complaining, start down that road where you're actually just walking down bitter road. Just stop, evaluate, consider the trial, consider what is happening. And after careful evaluation, James says, it should lead to a pure joy. Okay, this is kind of messed up, right? How is it possible if you're getting slammed right in the midst of a trial, whatever that trial is, your response after evaluation should be joy. And not just any kind of joy, pure joy. That's a paradox to me. How is it possible that in the midst of the fire, the storm, the trial, the test, I can actually have a response where I have an attitude, not an emotion, of just joy? And I wanted to clarify, joy doesn't mean you're walking around with a big, fat, cheesy grin on your face, just, I'm loving life. My life is falling apart, but I love it. That's not what James is talking about, not just this superficial happiness, as it were. It's a joy is an attitude that influences or impacts your entire being. It's a joy is an attitude. It's a deep-seated attitude that will influence, impact how you respond, how you act. And pure, just so you know, means complete or whole. That's what the actual Greek word for pure that James is using here. So this is a whole joy or a complete joy. Not saying I'm going to be joyful in this part of my life, but over here, I'm going to become bitter. I'm going to become angry. I'm going to become frustrated and have this compartmentalized life where just a small part of you is joyful. James says, when trials come, pure joy. Consider it pure joy. Complete, whole joy. Have you ever been watching TV and, I don't know, you're enjoying the game, you're enjoying that favorite show of yours, and all of a sudden, out of nowhere, the emergency broadcast network decides to like flip on the test, and this annoying screen and beeping, buzzing comes up, and this is now a test. I mean, you're right in the middle of trying to find out what Jack Bauer's going to do next, and all of a sudden, this emergency test comes on. Totally disrupts what you're doing, what you're enjoying. Well, this is how trials work. Without warning, without notice, sometimes in life, a lot of times in life, this is how it works. You are now in a test. You are now in a trial. Whenever, he says, trials come up, And I don't know about you, but I've often experienced the trials come up when I don't have time for them. I don't need them right now. It's the most inconvenient, inopportune times that trials happen, that trials come up. That's just the nature of trials. And James says we are to be joyful whenever they come up, not when it's convenient, not when it fits your schedule, not when you can work it into your day timer. Whenever trials come up, convenient, inconvenient, opportune, inopportune time, whenever they come up, we are to experience joy. Okay, I don't, if you haven't asked this yet, obvious, what is a trial? What does trial actually mean? The way James is talking about it here is something that tries or tests us. Something that will put your faith on the witness stand with the purpose of discovering the quality or worth of your faith. We'll get into this a little bit later because this is a theme that will come back up again, but I'll plant the seed now. Where do trials come from? Is it just from God? Is it from Satan, God's enemy? Is it just part of the ebb and flow of life? Is it part of just result of dumb things we do? Where do trials come from? I mean, the quick answer certainly is God is in control of everything. Nothing takes him by surprise. So if you're in the midst of a trial, God's not up in heaven being like, oh my goodness, I did not see that one coming. So trials are things that try us or test us for discovering the quality or worth of our faith. And this is plural. He doesn't say trial, trials, meaning there will be many that we will endure, many that we will go through. And he says there will be many kinds. I could come up with a really long list of the many kinds of trials that we have, but I don't think I need to. Emotional, relational, physical, mental. I mean, just cover the whole spectrum. We will be, humanity is going to go through trials of many kinds. And nowhere does the Bible actually say that trials are ever easy. James is not copying the attitude that when you go through a trial, it's just a piece of cake. It's going to be real easy. But he does give wisdom of how we are to be responding to when trials come. Now, this might sound odd, but it needs to be said, don't be a storm chaser. You ever see Twister? These crazy people who just loved chasing after tornadoes. That was like their passion in life. There are people who actually chase trials, who they live for trial to trial to trial. Now, you might be that person, and you might be sitting next to someone who's saying, that's ridiculous. Why would someone do that? I've seen a lot of people and met with a lot of people who they just jump from trial to trial, either pridefully just trying to prove their character, or what I've seen more often is the case, their identity gets so formed around the trials they're in that if they're not in a trial, they don't know who they are. So don't be a person who goes looking for trials. They'll find you, don't worry. Don't be a person who just goes and chases the storms. I have one person in mind a long time ago, but she lived for the trials, her identity. She thought that people only cared about her when she was in the midst of a trial. So don't be a person that just goes and chases the trials and the storms. Trials or the testing of our faith should result, in perseverance, as James says. So we need to learn not to run from the trial, but we need to learn how to run within the trial. Joyful attitude that produces perseverance, as James says. So my question then is, what's going to keep you in the trial? Because our first gut reaction response is not often joy, and our second response is to bail. Right? Because it's going to get tough, so the easiest thing to do is just to tap out, to bail. So what is going to actually keep you in terms of persevering through the trial, learning how to run in the trial, not running away from the trial? Well, you have to ask the question, is there some sort of benefit? If I stay in this trial, am I going to get any benefit out of this? I mean, imagine we would have no more kids if women said, well, I'm just not going to get pregnant anymore because it's too doggone tough. My body just freaks out. It's too painful. It's too hard. I'm not going to do pregnancy anymore. Well, of course, that doesn't happen because, yes, they look at 9 months of a lot of changes, and they look at certainly the pain that they will endure. Praise God for new drugs. But the pain that they still endure, and they say, well, the benefit is I get to be part of creating life, and I get to be part of birthing a child. And so the benefit far outweighs them bailing and saying, well, forget it, I'm just not going to get pregnant. So what's going to keep you in the midst of the trial, persevering, as it were, through the trial? Well, James says that after perseverance, it will lead us to a place where we be mature, complete, not lacking anything. So the bottom line is, do you really consider maturity, completeness, a place in your life where you're not lacking anything? Is that really worth it? Because if it's not, when a trial comes, you'll bail. So do you really consider being mature, being complete, not lacking anything? Is that really a benefit to you? Is that really worth it? Tristan, my son, is getting ready to turn 5 here in a month or two. Imagine if Tristan came to me and said, Dad, I'm done. What do you mean, Tristan? Well, I'm 5. I've decided I'm stopping. Well, what do you mean you're stopping? Well, I've kind of looked beyond, and it's going to be a tough road. It's going to be hard turning 6, Dad. And I just don't know if I'm up for going through the trials of being 6 and 7 and 8 and then going into preschool and middle school and high school. And Dad, I'm going to be 5. I'm done. I mean, well, first of all, it's not an option. But second of all, how much life would he miss out on if he just stopped and said, I'm done. I'm not going to mature anymore. I'm not pursuing being a complete human soul and human heart. Is the benefit of actually being mature, being complete, not lacking anything, is it really worth it to you? I mean, a question, do you really want to look the same 12 weeks from now? I mean, do you really just want to look the same? Spiritually speaking, relationally, emotionally, physically, do you just want to look the same? Isn't there something that stirs within your heart that says, I want more? Yes, I want to mature. I want to see transformation in my life. Are you satisfied with just being where you are right now? Not maturing beyond the place that you've gotten to. Well, James very clearly says that trials produce perseverance or endurance, and if we stay in the midst of the trial, it leads to a place where completeness and maturity, where we are not lacking anything. So if you just consider, if you evaluate the trial that you find yourself in, and you look down the road a little bit and says, you know what? This is leading to character growth. This is leading to maturity. This is leading to completeness, where I don't lack anything. You got to make up your own mind, but I've made up my mind. It's worth it. So I don't cop the attitude of, yeah, bring the trials on. But I do have the attitude and the commitment that when trials come, I will pursue joy, complete joy, pure joy. Now, this sounds good so far. Maybe it doesn't to you, but let's be realistic, okay? On paper, it sounds really good. Yes, it sounds great. Let's have an attitude of complete or pure joy. Let's get the perseverance and endurance going. And maturity, completeness, not lacking anything. I love it. It sounds great. But let's be honest. When it really hits and it hits hard and you're in the midst of the pain and you can't see the purpose, what are you supposed to do? This is what I love about James, because it is so practical of what life with Christ looks like. And when trials hit, this is what we are to do. This is what should be our response. But in our humanness, our response is, this just hurts too much. It's too painful. And so James goes on and gives the answer of what we are supposed to do. Verse 5 through 8. If any of you lacks wisdom, he should ask God, who gives generously to all without finding fault, and it will be given to him. But when he asks, he must believe and not doubt, because he who doubts is like a wave of the sea, blown and tossed by the wind. That man should not think he will receive anything from the Lord. He is a double-minded man, unstable in all he does. Last trial you went through, remember the one you were thinking about? What was your first response? Who was the first person that you called? Because, I mean, typically when trials come, what's the first thing we do? We talk to our spouse, if you have a spouse. We talk to a friend, a boyfriend, a girlfriend, someone we're in relationship to. I don't know, you buy a book on the subject, you Google the issue. Why is it that our first response typically is not to go to God? This is not accusatory. This is me as well. My first response, it's a lot easier sometimes just to talk to Kyla, and it's not really talking, it's complaining, to be honest with you. What is it that our first response doesn't actually draw us to go to God? We're so drawn just to go to the internet, to a book, to a friend, a relationship. And by the way, I'm not saying it's bad to seek counsel or to offer to have someone offer guidance. That's not the point, but that's not the first thing we do. If we lack wisdom about the trial, James says we are to turn to God. Why is that so hard? The answer, I think, is in verse 5. If any of you lacks wisdom, he should ask God, who gives generously to all without finding fault, and it will be given to him. It takes humility, doesn't it? To recognize that you lack something, and then you're willing to go and ask the person who has it. It takes a pretty humble spirit to say, I don't have this. I am lacking this. I have something I need. That person has it. And I will be humble enough to recognize that I'm lacking it. And I will be humble enough to go and to ask. So James makes it pretty simple. If you lack something, ask God. And notice that it doesn't say, ask God to remove you from the trial. It says, ask God to give you wisdom about the trial. And biblical wisdom is not this abstract form of knowledge. Wisdom is what gives us the ability to understand what God's doing, understand God's ways, God's purpose. And the wise person who knows that then orients his life, her life, around what God has revealed. That is a wise person. The opposite is a fool, who knows the right thing, the God thing to do, but refuses to do it. So James is saying, if you lack wisdom to actually understand the trial that you are in, then you ask God. And I love the picture that he says to us about God, what we learn from God in just one verse. First thing, God cares. He doesn't want you walking through a trial confused. He wants you walking through a trial confident that he is at work. God is generous. As I stand here before you today, one of the things that God is teaching me over the last many, many months is he is a generous God. He is generous in mercy and compassion and forgiveness, but he's also generous in giving wisdom. So if you're not experiencing the generosity of God, it's not because he's holding out on you. It might just simply be because you're not asking. You're not asking God to be generous or to give. God gives without finding fault. I love that. He doesn't look at our prior record and say, nope, you're not worthy of it. I'm holding that thing against you. God cares, he's generous, and he gives without finding fault. Your previous record, he doesn't hold that against you. He gives without finding fault. This is so contrary to how things work with us. Because we often don't give because of what the person hasn't given to us. That's how it works. But it doesn't work that way with God. And the second thing, or the fourth thing about God is he's faithful. If you ask, it's going to be given. Now this is where it starts to get pretty hard. If it hasn't gotten hard already, this is where it starts to get hard. And James knows that and says, don't be double-minded. If you ask, would you believe? Don't doubt. Because if you're doubting, you're nothing better than a wave of the sea that's just tossed back and forth at the will of the wind. If you ask, believe that God will actually give it to you. This is the duplicitness of humanity. We say one thing with our mouth, but we don't actually believe that God will do it. And James is pretty clear. He says, if that's you, you're not going to receive anything, because you actually don't believe that God will give. Now, to the person who's thinking, well, I thought it was okay to have doubts. Doubts that lead to belief. If you're thinking, I don't know if you are, there's a story in Mark where there's a father who has a son who is just not in good shape. And he wants Jesus to heal his son. Do you believe that I can do this? I do, but help me in my unbelief. He wanted to go to a place where he would have solid belief. He was looking to believe. The duplicit person, the double-minded person, is completely torn. They say this, but then they do this intentionally. Their doubt is not actually wanting to go to a place where they have greater faith. They're actually being intentional about, I believe that, I'm saying this, but I actually don't believe that God, because I ask you, you'll actually give. So James says very clearly, if that's you, that individual will receive nothing. So when you ask for wisdom, would you please trust, would you believe this to be truth, that God is more desirous to give you wisdom than you are actually wanting to receive it? That's who God is. Why? Because he cares. Why? Because he's generous. Why? Because he gives without finding fault. Why? Because he's faithful. He is more bent on providing good, providing wisdom, in this case for you, than we're actually wanting to receive the good or the wisdom that he has for us. A theme that James will actually work throughout his letter is this issue of the poor and the wealthy. And some people, you might read this next few verses and be like, well, this is coming out of left field. What is he actually talking about? But James makes a very practical example of the trials that come with poverty and the trials that actually come with wealth. He says this, the brother in humble circumstances ought to take pride in his high position, but the one who is rich should take pride in his low position, because he will pass away like a wild flower. Listen to the imagery James uses. For the sun rises with a scorching heat and withers the plant. It blossoms, falls, and its beauty is destroyed. In the same way, the rich man will fade away even while he goes about his business. About 85 to 90% of the world's population lives in poverty. Poverty is a real trial. For some of us, it is a real trial. And James says, in the midst of this trial called poverty, where the world looks at you and says, you're nothing, and casts you into this place where you're insignificant because you don't have the socioeconomic standing that we do. James says, remember, in the midst of this trial, remember that your value, your place of who you are in God and who you are in Jesus Christ is far greater than any position or place you could ever have this side of on earth here. Take pride in your high position. You might feel low, but remember who you are in God's eyes. Remember who you are in your identity in Jesus. And then he says the trial for the rich Christians, economically speaking, is that they can become arrogant, self-satisfied, dependent not on God, but on self. And to me, it's a tragedy when one's wealth deceives a person into thinking that they don't need anything. They don't need anyone, and they certainly don't need God. Why? Because they have everything they need in their finances. That's a trial. Now, some of us were like, I'd prefer to have the trials of the rich over the trials of the poor. Well, really? I wouldn't. Some of the most wealthy people I know are some of the most miserable people I know. And that's not a judgment statement on them. That's just the reality that this myth that money gets and buys happiness. I don't know who started that lie, but it continues on and on. And a sobering truth that James gives is if you really want to have the trials of the rich, well, just remember, his riches, her riches, is no more permanent than that of a wildflower. Those who trust in wealth will be sorely disappointed because it will fade, and it will fade very quickly. Very practical examples that James gives in the poverty and the wealth. And then he finishes off, what we'll stop with today is chapter 1, verse 12. Finishes off with a promise. Blessed is the man who perseveres under trial, because when he has stood the test, he will receive the crown of life that God has promised to those who love him. How do you know? How do you know if you've passed the test? How do you know if you stood the test? I don't know where I heard this or who first explained this to me, but it was a great illustration of a goldsmith. They're heating gold for the purposes of purification. And they would know completely when the gold had been completely refined, had been completely purified, when the goldsmith could look into the pot, as it were, and see his reflection. And I really think that what God is trying to do in us to bring us to maturity, to bring us to completeness, where we're not lacking anything, ultimately what that means is he's bringing us to Christ-likeness. And so in the midst of trials, I have this picture that God is looking. He's saying, no, I don't see the reflection of my son. I see anger, actually. I see worry, actually. I see anxiety. I see bitterness. I don't see Jesus. And so the trial continues. The purpose, the point of the trial is to grow Christ-likeness in us. That we would persevere, not run away from, but we would learn to run in. A place of maturity and completeness where we are not lacking anything. To that person who stood the test, James says there is a reward. The crown of life, where the actual imagery is, at the end of a race, this person would receive a wreath put on top of their head saying, you are the victor. You've experienced victory. And it seems almost as a throwaway line that is easy to miss, but God has promised to those who love him. In the midst of your trials, God is actually trying to stir in you a heart that would love him actually even more. Hence, really, the title of this message, will you be joyful or will you be jaded? Will the trial that you might even be in right now, the one that's actually waiting for you tomorrow, the one that you've just come out of, do you love God more because of where he took you and walked with you through the midst of that trial, the midst of that test? And James says it's creating in us in a heart that would love to, that would love God more. How does it, is it really possible? Is it really possible to go through a trial? I know this sounds good on paper. Is it really possible to actually go through trials, be joyful, experience perseverance, endurance, get to a place of maturity, completeness, where we not lack anything? One of my closest friends, his name is Chuck, lives in the great state of Ohio. Chuck's life was rocked probably about 8 years ago when his son committed suicide. I remember getting the phone call from the police saying, can you come up to the school? Mark has hung himself, and the parents aren't able to work with us right now, so they've asked if you can come. And I said, okay. And I mean, it was the most horrific situation I had ever been in up to that point. Working with Chuck, working with Linda through the suicide of their son. At that point in time, Chuck did not really, he knew of God, but did not know God in a personal way. And that trial that Chuck went through, consequently his wife Linda went through as well, led them to a place where they said, God is good. And they actually began, through that suicide, a relationship with God. Fast forward maybe, this was just this past year. Chuck and Linda. They've been doing just phenomenal, really just growing in the relationship with God, and experienced a lot of healing. And just so you know, if you've ever been through a suicide, it's a lifelong process of healing from that pain. Chuck called me, I don't know, maybe a year and a half ago, and said, hey, Linda's been diagnosed with a very terminal cancer. She's young, actually. And so it was kind of I know cancer can come whether you're 5 years old or 50 years old. But Michael, Linda's been diagnosed, and they haven't given her long to live. And so I said, man, Chuck, I'll be praying for you. And she didn't live long. And I remember this last fall, after the diagnosis, I think there was maybe about 5-6 months, and Chuck called and said, probably about a day, not much longer, so if you can come, we'd love for you to come. You guys are being nice right now, so thank you. And I remember just driving to Ohio, almost in silence the whole time, just praying for Chuck, not even knowing it's going to be Chuck and his wife literally in the house. She was in hospice care at the time, not knowing what to expect, not knowing what it would even be like. I'd never been around someone who literally was hours away from their death, and this was last fall, and it was phenomenal. I walked in, and Chuck had joy. It was amazing. I thought I was going to see a pretty broken man, because yet another trial had hit him, had hit his family. And I just remember sitting there laughing with Chuck and just talking and enjoying, and Linda was in and out of just being there, being aware. The thing that I just remember, she passed literally a few hours after that, and I just remember seeing what we're talking about lived out. It does work. You can go through a trial and experience and have an attitude, not an emotion, not a feeling, but an attitude of joy. It started 7-8 years ago when his son took his life. He was introduced to God for the first time. And through that trial, he was able to learn joy and perseverance, so that the next time the trial came, the joy had already been born within him. And it was really a question of just persevering. I tell you this story not to make you cry. I tell you this story to let you know it's possible. I've seen it. I've not always lived this out myself. But if you're going to live a life well lived, then when trials come, and they will, in many forms, you'll have an attitude of joy. I hope that when I get back, get to the end of my life and survey the situation, I'll say, you know what? When the trials came, there was attitude of joy. There was perseverance. There was maturity. There was completeness. I'm a work in progress. I'm still growing in that place. But a life well lived, when trials come, you have joy. You don't become jaded. If we can, let's just bow our heads for a minute and close with prayer. As I'm speaking now, I know that some of you, this is all too real. You're literally in the thick of it right now. All I can do is just encourage you to do what James said to do, is to ask for wisdom. I'm not going to pray that God would remove you from the trial, but I will pray that God would give you wisdom in the midst of the trial, so that you would be able to understand, have his perspective, gain perseverance, and go to a place of maturity and completeness. You might be in the midst of it right now. And as I said earlier, your trial might be coming tomorrow, next week, next month. I'm going to pray that you'll remember when it comes, evaluate. Ask God for the perspective, for the wisdom that you need to walk through that trial. And I also understand that there might be some here today, if not many, who you will have not be able to understand any of these things until you know God. And I would invite you this day to begin that relationship with God. Jesus said himself, there's only one way we can have a relationship with God, and it's through faith in him. If you're in a place where you haven't even made that decision yet, then can I encourage you, exhort you, compel you to make that decision, to begin that relationship with God through Jesus Christ. We do that by just confessing that we've sinned and fallen short, and we do that by believing and receiving that Jesus Christ paid the penalty for sin, and that through faith in him, we are made right with God. Father, maybe that's someone's prayer right now. And Father, if there is one, if not many here today who don't know you in a right way, in a real way, that you would hear the prayer of their heart, calling out to know you, confessing sin, and claiming that Jesus is the one who paid penalty for sin, and putting faith and belief and trust in him, and him alone. Father, for some who are literally in the thick of it right now, I do not ask that you would remove them, but I do ask that you'd give them wisdom. God, please grant wisdom to those who find themselves in the thick of things right now. God, please bless with wisdom. And God, for those who have gone through trials and come out the other side angry, bitter, frustrated, God, would you please draw those hearts back to you and stir an attitude of joy to perseverance, to maturity. And God, for those who maybe tomorrow, maybe next week or next month, a trial will come, God, would you help them to evaluate the trial, knowing that the benefit of maturity and completeness, not lacking a thing, far outweighs tapping out, running away. God, I thank you that you care. I thank you that you are generous. I thank you that you give without finding fault. And I thank you that you are faithful.